Welcome to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. First up on today's show, we'll hear about what it's like to be an only child with an only child. Journalist Lauren Sandler joined me in 2013 to talk about her book, One and Only. She took a year to investigate what the lives of only children are like, who they are, and how society perceives them. Are they as spoiled as the stereotype? She also explores why parents make the choice to have only one child and why they are often harshly judged for doing so. Let's give it a listen. I struggled with those two words, only child, because even those two words seem so loaded.
You know, it's funny. There's a researcher at Harvard who writes about only children, and she will not use the term in her writing because she thinks it's a derogatory term. She writes singleton instead.
Does that make sense to you? Does it feel less freighted, less loaded?
I guess. I mean, singleton is a weird word, though. It means a lot of different things. But it is interesting that only child does seem to have so much bias and judgment behind it.
You have described, you know, being in a supermarket or strangers, in a sense, commenting on your child and then asking, you know, where's the other one or when is the other one coming?
Usually what happens, and I've had this encounter many times and I've heard from many parents of only children who have had it too, that you have that lovely moment with a stranger fawning over your adorable kid, and then they ask if you're having another one or when, and you say you're not planning on it, and everything freezes.
Really?
And suddenly I've heard the sentence, you wouldn't do that to your child, from complete strangers, more than I could possibly tell you. Luckily, I don't hear it from my family or friends, but that's where other people get pressure too.
Which is turning your only child into a selfish, lonely, neurotic, unhappy, unfriendly person?
Exactly. I am clearly automatically screwing up my child by not giving her a sibling. And I must be doubly selfish, right? Because I'm an only child with an only child. What could be worse?
And do you think women feel that or accused of that being selfish more than men, for instance?
Yes. I don't know if I've actually interviewed a single man who has had that bias leveled against him. It is really something that mothers hear.
I have to say, I have one child. It was not my intention, but that's what I ended up with. And I know there are times when he was growing up when he would have loved to have siblings just so he could, you know, complain frankly about his parents. And there were times when it was just him against us. And I think in many ways it was a really unfair fight.
I actually learned recently that I am not alone in nicknaming my parents the United Front. In fact, the day after my book came out, my parents greeted me for breakfast wearing T-shirts that said the United Front on them. It was hilarious. But it does feel like that you are inherently outnumbered if you have two parents. And even if you have one, you have one parent with power. I, however, found that having close friends made all the difference to me. And I have friends from my adolescence who are still like siblings to me and still talk about my parents as though we are siblings together. And so I do think that you end up with chosen family in a very intentional and special way.
And I wonder how common that is, because I have to say that my son has always had very intense and loving and deep relationship, friendships, frankly, with people in his life.
It's very common. We do tend to nurture friendships as though they are family relationships.
You looked at a lot of the research about single children or only children and looked at this notion of selfishness. And that seems to be the tag that is followed only kids. Is there any truth to that, that single children are any more selfish than other children?
Within the data, there is no truth. And so in terms of the stereotype of only children being lonely and selfish and maladjusted, there have been hundreds and hundreds of studies over decades that disprove this idea. The question of spoiling comes up as a part of this, but to me, that's just a question of mindful parenting. Mm-hmm. So you can spoil a bunch of kids or you can spoil one kid, and that's really something which is on the parents, I think, and not an inherent condition of an only child.
Because clearly with, let's say, parents or even a parent of an only or single child, that child is the focus of so much attention.
It's true. And you have to know to pull that focus back. And that can be tough to do. It takes a lot of awareness. And one-child family has less diversity than other families. There's less competition for attention. And then there are also fewer personality types that are buzzing in the air. And so that does change the dynamic. But it's interesting. The only places in which only children tend to differ in the research from kids with siblings are in terms of intelligence, self-esteem, and achievement motivation. And the way to understand those higher scores in those regards is because of that undiluted attention and energy that all of those resources put into one kid can be really good for them.
Did you, though, go through a period of wanting siblings?
I didn't as a kid. I thought about it occasionally as an adolescent. You know, in my mid to late 30s, it also occurs to me sometimes. But I've never wanted it enough to really want it. I've been curious about it, you know, and there are moments in which I've thought, man, I really wish I could get someone else into this conversation.
Sure.
The question of choice, I think, can be a little complicated, in part because I think one of the main reasons that we have such a growing number of only children is delayed fertility. This is why there are fewer children in the U.S. in general right now, why our families keep getting smaller, is because we put off having kids, because we're looking for the right romantic partner, because we want our work lives to be in the right place, which we all know they never will be, but we say it's not the right time. And it often isn't the right time for legitimate reasons. And then it's funny because you get to the point where your body says, okay, it's going to be one and done for you. Mm. And then it doesn't feel like a choice. And I think it would be so good for people to own the power of those choices to say, yeah, I did wait. And I waited to have these things in my life that would make me happy so I could be a good parent. And now I have a kid that I love. And let's do this instead of feeling the pain of not being able to have a bigger family. Because I do think it is so hard to not have a second kid when you really want one. But I do wonder if we felt more empowered by the things that often lead us there. And also if we could dial down the bias and judgment, if that pain would be quite so acute.
There are a number of ways to end up with one child. One is choice, as you just said, but also there are some people, and I would include myself, that wanted more children. It just didn't happen for a whole host of reasons that I won't go in over the air. And some people get divorced and you end up with one child. So that there are reasons for single children. Some of them are less joyous and satisfying, I think, than others.
It's true. Life is complicated and unexpected. But we all know that, and yet we continue to put this pressure on parents to have more kids. We continue to say, if you don't have more kids, you're a bad parent. Your kid is going to turn out rotten. And that really doesn't help.
Your book is tapped into that enduring parental or even maternal anxiety about, am I doing this right? Am I, you know, do I have the right number of children, or am I taking them to enough classes?
Right. And it's interesting. One of the figures that stuck with me most in my research was that most people say that they have their first child for themselves and they have their second child for the benefit of their first child. And I wonder what would happen if we had different information out there about who only children really were, if we would still feel like those second kids were as necessary. Because I know plenty of people who want them desperately and have that desire, and I think that's great. My concern is for people who don't have that desire and still think that it's really necessary.
You had mentioned your parents, and I'm curious about their response to this book.
And it was interesting because most of us, or at least people I know, don't tend to really actively investigate their family's choices quite so much. So when I sat down with my parents and learned that it was actually something my father was quite ambivalent about, that he did have some longing for another kid. He wanted to know what it would be like to have a second child. That was a real eye-opener for me. And I do think that in most couples, it's unusual to have two people who want the exact same thing. And, you know, my husband and I tend to be pretty like-minded about this. If I wanted another one, he'd go with it.
Right.
But, you know, he wanted that first one and I went with that. So, you know, I think that it can be a tough debate within a marriage.
Reading your book, though, I was also thinking about our family policies. I won't say friendly policies because they're not particularly friendly in this country when you look at other countries like France, but how difficult we make it having children in this country anyway.
There's one researcher on parental happiness who, and I will paraphrase here, said to me, we tell you to do it more than anyone else, we tell you to love it more than anyone else, and we'll give you less help than anyone else. And it's true, in ranking family policy globally, it's not just Europe that tops the U.S. The U.S. actually vies between third and fourth place as the worst country in the world. We are bested by Suriname and Liberia. We have the same family policy as Swaziland. Mm. So this isn't just a question of, you know, the EU's got it worked out and we're backwards. It's not that old conversation. It's that, you know, what we once called the third world offers significantly more help than we do here.
You really got into a bit of a tussle with a piece that you wrote in The Atlantic. And here's the headline. The secret to being both a successful writer and a mother, : have just one kid. Now, the headline kind of distorts what you wrote in the article, but nonetheless, a lot of women writers push back really hard on you.
It's true. And what's sad is I never even knew about that title until I went onto the website and saw my article.
And you went, ah.
Yeah, I thought, oh, this is not
good. Here it comes.
I mean, it's funny. I'm not someone who's afraid of a little controversy. I know that the things that I tend to believe can set people off. When I was researching my book, I noticed that four women writers I really admire, all of whom were journalists, Mary McCarthy, Elizabeth Hardwick, Joan Didion, and Susan Sontag, all had one child. And I thought to myself, I wonder how their lives and their writing would be different if they had more. So I wrote this very sort of nerdy, narrow essay for The Atlantic about it. And then they slapped this headline on, and before I knew it, I had Jane Smiley saying, listen, I wrote 23 books and won a Pulitzer, and I have three kids and two stepkids. You know, coming into the comments and telling me that I was dead wrong about this. And I think that that's great that Jane Smiley got to do that.
Sure.
She got to do that with a lot of help from her local university with childcare and a lot of book advances that most writers don't ever get to see. Zadie Smith came in and said, Dickens and Tolstoy had 10 kids. And I'm thinking, how many meals do you think Tolstoy prepared and how many sippy cups do you think Dickens was washing back then? I do know that most women who write either have no kids or two or more kids. And so clearly you can write with more kids and you can be creative with more or none. But this is a choice, you know, or a circumstance of being a writer with one child, which is something which is so vilified in the public to have just one child, mm-hmm. that it was a way to say, let's consider the richness of a life with just one.
Well, what I found so interesting, we could do a whole show about it, was just, and it seems it's a kind of a deja vu all over again, which is a woman writes something about her life and choosing either work, family, or some version of that and children. And frankly, women pounce.
It's funny because I've worked very hard to write a book and write a series of related articles that are not terribly divisive, that right. say, you know, if this is your family, it's okay. That's all I'm doing is saying it's okay. And yet that feels like it is me throwing down a gauntlet in the mommy wars. But and it's hard to avoid that, apparently.
Sure. Well, and the mommy wars always has this sort of competitive undertone, it seems to me, mm-hmm. which I think makes it so troublesome.
And I think it's a major distraction from the conversations that I believe we need to be having about policy in this country, about how to actually manage the conflict between work and parenthood. And instead of, you know, demanding better law, instead of demanding more support, we're just going at each other's throats on the blogosphere, and that makes me crazy.
That was my conversation with journalist Lauren Sandler. She joined us in 2013 to discuss her book, One and Only, The Freedom of Having an Only Child and the Joy of Being One. When we get back from the break, we'll revisit my conversation with author Lenore Skenazy, dubbed America's Worst Mom in 2008. This was after writing about her experience of allowing her then 9-year-old son to ride alone on the subway in New York City. Stay with us. This is Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The free-range kids movement has roared back into the news, with parents being threatened with arrest for child endangerment for leaving their kids alone even for a short time, or allowing them to walk home by themselves or ride public transit without an adult. Have parents become overprotective of their children, or is adult supervision the new normal for childhood? Lenore Skenazy earned the title of America's Worst Mom after writing about her experience of allowing her then 9-year-old son to ride the subway alone in New York. She joined me in 2009 to discuss her book, Free Range Kids, Giving Our Kids the Freedom We Enjoyed Without Going Nuts with Worry. She wrote about her experience of hitting the interview circuit with her dubious moniker, the importance of giving kids independence, and the effects of over-anxious parenting. Let's give it a listen. And I wonder whether you're ever going to get past this story of your son, Izzy.
No, I was thinking, like, you know, here lies Lenore Skenazy, whatever year I die, she let her son.
Indeed she did. And why did you do that, Lenore Skenazy?
Lenore Skenazy did that because her son, Izzy, is just a cool guy who is very interested in the world. And, you know, last year he'd been asking my husband and me, if he could just please get home someplace by himself. And I think of it as the sort of urban equivalent of, like, could you please let go of the handlebars already? Right. I'm ready to ride this bike myself, Mom. And so my husband and I talked about it, and we decided, yeah, why not? I mean, he knows how to read the subway map. He knows his directions. We've been on the subway all the time, so it was very familiar to him. And as we are on the subway all the time, we see what it's like. It's not like, I mean, I finally watched The Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and if that's what the subway was with, you know, a maniacal John Travolta, you know, laughing, you know, as he shoots people, I would think that that was not the place for my 9-year-old son to be. But, in fact, it's just a way of getting around, and there's always so many people on it, and there's cops, and it struck me as safety in numbers. And the subway stop that I left him above when I left him at the subway was it's Bloomingdale's is above it, okay? And so that's just a very sort of hoity-toity neighborhood on a Sunday afternoon, and I knew it would be crowded, and it was. I mean, he got home no problem, and it was surprising to me that everybody thinks of it as, you know, I'm going to lead these people into the desert for 40 years, and my name is Izzy Canadian. Like, no, that wasn't it. It was just a rite of passage. Since then, I mean, I feel like I've learned a lot in writing my book and in talking to a million people. And guess what? Now he has a cell phone. And guess what? He's lost it twice. You know, it felt safe to me when I let him go on the train, but only afterwards did I learn that New York is as safe as it was in 1963. I mean, we are of the 25 largest cities in America. I hate to say this to Philly, but we're the safest. We're the safest.
Well, so, actually, we know that.
Right? You know that, okay.
We do. But, you know, and I'm glad you raised that, because I think probably people listening to us in Philadelphia, there are some neighborhoods in Philadelphia where you hear gunfire every night.
That's terrifying.
It is terrifying. And clearly there are neighborhoods where parents, and I think legitimately, do not let their children out
totally.
Of their sight. And you,
you
understand that, right?
Not only do I understand that, I mean, free range never says be heedless of danger. I am like I think of myself as a safety addict. I mean, I really believe in safety belts. You know, my kids don't even get into a cab and not put on their safety belt. They do. You know, my kids ride bikes with their helmets on. They were in car seats until they were like 15. I mean, really, I believe in safety. I just don't believe in you know, that in a relatively safe neighborhood, your kids need to have a security detail around them every time they go outside. All free range says is that kids want to be part, you know, they want to grow up. And we've been so worried about them for the last, I don't know, 15 or 20 years that we've been almost sitting on them and saying, no, you won't grow up. I'm going to walk you to school. I'm going to drive you to the bus stop. I'm going to make your bed. I'm not going to let you do the fun things and the boring things that you need to do to grow up.
I'm curious about the kind of childhood you had. I'm a bit older than you.
I bet you're not.
No, I grew up in the 50s and the 60s, so I'm probably a bit older
than
you.
All right, a little.
Exactly. That's how I feel. And I grew up in the country, and essentially, we didn't even have a television set.
Wow.
I mean, my parents, that's how old. That's
we
how
had
old.
A horse and a buggy.
But
like,
I remember
made our soap.
Exactly. No, but I remember basically on Saturdays being kicked out of the house and then making your way, mostly climbing trees and, you know, doing whatever 8 and 9 year old kids did, and then sort of wandering home late on in the afternoon. And I'm just curious about your childhood.
Mine was so much less fun than that. You know, I don't think I climbed a tree, even though here I am encouraging everyone, go out and climb a tree. I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, very safe. You know, the parents all moved there for the schools. And I was outside too, but I was so boring. All I did was look for four-leaf clovers. Can you believe a child spent her entire youth doing that? I mean, you know, there was always a kickball game in front of my house, but I didn't like that, and I would just sit there on the side and look for four-leaf clovers. But in the, you know, stuff that I did that was just totally normal and nobody thought twice about was, of course, I walked to school, you know, starting in first grade. And, of course, I rode my bike to the library or to the pool. And, of course, the pool actually had a diving board back then. Imagine that, even a high dive. And so, you know, in my, I wouldn't call it like a Huck Finnish childhood whatsoever, but I was given the same kind of independence that everybody was given back then without a second thought. And with my mother being, you know, a nervous stay-at-home mom whose one goal in life was to help me and my sister make it through to adulthood. But back then it wasn't considered a crazy thing to let your kid walk to school.
Why do you think then, and this is a broad generalization, obviously, but what do you think makes today's parents so anxious?
we do have to start with the media, because when my parents were raising me, which was a little after your parents were raising you,
right.
they still were not awash in 24/7 horrible headline news Nancy Grace stories like you get if you flip on the TV today. You know, they would watch the nightly news, and that would be it, but it wouldn't be on all the time and sending camera crews to Portugal when there's a girl kidnapped, or to Aruba. I mean, it was, you weren't beamed in abduction stories from around the world the way you are now, to the point where it feels like there's an abduction going on every second of the day, but only because that's what the news organizations are hunting for. It's ratings gold. I mean, I hate to put it that way because it's, you know, we're talking about tragedies. But for television, my friend who works in cable television told me that, you know, this is what they look for. They look for a middle-class white girl because that's what people will watch, and that's what the advertisers want, are the eyeballs. And so on the news, you have just far more sensationalistic and insistent and 24-hour-a-day stories than you used to have. And then if you change the channel, like say you want to watch quote-unquote drama, which my parents would have been watching, like, I don't know, Marcus Welby or Dallas or something, but now it's, you know, it's CSI, Mentalist, Bones, Law and Order. It seeps into your consciousness. This just starts feeling like it's happening all the time, because it is. It just happens to be happening all the time on TV.
But it's interesting that people have sort of believed the unreality of television.
Yeah.
And, I mean, when you hear about these abduction stories, of course, as a parent, you identify.
You get sick. You get totally sick.
Sure, and you identify with the parents, and you imagine, what
right.
if that was my child?
Right. You can't not slot in your kid for child A, right. you know?
But you're saying we live in a far safer world than television would have us believe.
We live in a far safer world than when I was growing up. That's the weird thing. I mean, crime is back nationally to what it was in 1970, and it was actually higher in the 70s and 80s than it is now, because it started going down in the early 90s. But if you ask, you know, literally anyone except me, are we safer today? I mean, so many people come up to me, and they remember, as you do, you know, happy times as kids. They loved riding their bikes around. They liked meeting their friends in the park and organizing their own game, whether it was baseball or something they made up, you know. And they all talk about it as if this is what, you know, what they're made of. You know, it was like Wonder Bread for them. It was what created them as mm-hmm. they were kids. And yet they all say, but I can't do that now with my kid. You know, oh, I would never do that with my kid.
But I wanted to whether just the focus on achievement and doing well also kind of gloms parents onto kids as well. Go ahead, Lenore.
Alas, it does. And not only in parenting, but also in the schools. I mean, I can't tell you how many schools have cut back, including my kid's school, on recess and even free time as kindergartners and preschoolers, because they are so anxious to get the kids to do well on standardized tests. And the sad thing is, or maybe it's the good thing, is that what's coming out now is that one of the most important things for kids to do to grow up and to be smart and to take care of themselves is free play.
Hmm.
So they need more free play, not less. One of the things we have to do is get that critical mass of kids back outside, because so many of the neighborhoods you drive through, it looks like, you know, like you don't see any leaves on the ground because everybody's like been very good about getting up their leaves. It's the same with the kids, like they've been sucked up. And my book is filled with a lot of little tips on how to, like, baby steps on how to start going back free range. And one of them sort of dovetails with what we were talking about earlier about the media being so grim, is one of those hours that you were going to watch television, you know, with or without your kid, turn it off, turn off the CSI, and go outside and walk around and be outside and you know, teach your kid about the neighborhood and say hello to anybody else who's, like, wild enough to sit on their lawn for an evening and say hi to the local, I don't know, candy store, whatever is left, and remind yourself that this is the neighborhood that you moved to for a reason, and if it's not the one with the gunshots ringing out at night, you know, reconquer it. You're there for a reason. To make the abduction conversation a big part of your child's upbearing is just bizarre.
Well, and just to add a serious note here, when you look at children at risk, I guess statistically speaking, they're probably at greater risk from a family member from a stranger. I mean, that's
right.
Just
no, the
sad
numbers
reality.
Are, right. The numbers are just startlingly stark, which is that 50 children a year are killed by kidnappers, which is horrible and just unthinkable, but 1,000 are killed by family members and close acquaintances. But one of the things I suggest in terms of feeling comfortable with your kids being around each other and being back outside, you know, whether or not it's 1952 or not, is Start reconnecting with your neighbors and your neighborhoods, whether everybody is at home every single second or not. I do notice in the mornings at drop-off before school, which, by the way, became drop-off. It used to be arrival. Kids would arrive on their own. There are a ton of parents waiting outside for the school doors to open. And one of the other ideas I gave in my book is, you know, when you're there with your child and, you know, everybody else is there with their kid, whether it's at the bus stop waiting for the bus or at the schoolyard or at the soccer game, you know, say, listen, you know, I recognize your kids. You know, there's eight of us here. I'll watch your kids for you. You know, start reasserting the fact that you don't think the neighborhood is so dangerous. You don't think that each child needs their own personal bodyguard, and that this is what neighbors do. All these new studies coming out are saying that, you know, ironically, we've forgotten that there's a reason kids have been playing, you know, and bear cubs have been playing and probably minnows have been playing since the beginning of time. That's what they're programmed to do. That's how they learn to cooperate with each other and to come up with an idea and how to get themselves out of being bored. So it's stupid, but you almost have to schedule free time when you don't have something planned and you don't have the electronics on to force them into being like natural people again, finding something for themselves to do.
But do you think it's parents feeling just sort of overly responsible either to have their children go out and have adventures for themselves
or
to stay kind of glued to the couch, which is just whatever they do, parents are going to feel overly responsible for whatever happens.
Parents do feel, I mean, here I am, you know, feeling guilty even as I tell you these stories. And there's a whole chapter in my book called Relax, Not Every Little Thing You Do Has That Much Impact on Your Child's Development. Because it's true. We do worry. It's like, oh, I said he could have a cookie, and then I decided, no, it was too soon before dinner, and he's going to think that I'm a hypocrite, or I'm too harsh, or I'm mean, and, you know, he's going to be talking about that with his shrink in 20 years. It's like, no, he's not. It's a cookie. It's dinner. You know, get over it. And same with, you know, I have two different sons. I mean, once you have a second kid, you realize that, you know, they're not all made by who you are. Just like, you know, the older one will stay glued to the couch and the younger one will take a ball out and find something to do. So it's not all up to us. However, if you could get them to go outside a little bit or have to amuse themselves without an electronic good, you know, that's probably a good idea every once in a while, but don't kill yourself if it doesn't happen, because I'm not.
And you had mentioned baby knee pads, and you have a chapter on this, Lenore Scanese. I wonder if you could describe what that product was all about.
Baby knee pads actually exist, which they must have come along more recently than 11 years ago, because thank God nobody was trying to give any to me at any baby shower. They are pads that you're supposed to put on your kid to protect them while they crawl. And aside from the fact that they cost money, which is already bad, you shouldn't be wasting your money on this, what is a product like that saying? And that's really what I delve into in the book. It's like, once there are baby knee pads, then you start thinking that, A, maybe you should buy them, and that, B, maybe crawling is dangerous, and maybe it's something that I should be protecting my children from. And there's so many products like that at the Babies R Us, you know, bye-bye baby giant stores these days. There's helmets for when they're toddling, and there's this little duck thermometer that looks like a rubber duck that you can put in their bath water to see if it's too hot. You know, the duck says if it's too hot. And it's like, all these products are insinuating that your child is really in danger, you know, in a bath, while they're crawling, while they're toddling, and that if you don't do something very proactive and very labor-intensive, like, you know, putting on these stupid things, which I had my neighbor put these baby pads on her baby because I wanted to take a picture, and, you know, it took a while and a lot of crying,
And did they work? I mean, was the baby able to crawl with these
knee pads? The baby was crying. The baby wasn't doing anything. The baby wasn't going anywhere. She was just upset, and so was I. But what a great picture, I have to say. You know? For my purposes, everything was fine. She was stuck with a crying baby. The thing is that, you know, thank God evolution has created a species called humans, which comes into being with, like, chubby knees covered with baby fat so that they will crawl. You know, it's a normal stage of evolution.
How do you get parents to stop being so nervous? Well, when they are bombarded with, you know, fears of children in buckets and Sesame Street videos with warnings that come on them.
I have a bunch of ideas, and I don't think any one of them is the silver bullet or the silver bucket. one is, when you're doing something that everybody else has decided is just too dangerous because what if? Like, if you're letting your 8-year-old stay home for half an hour while you go pick up a prescription, you know, or letting your kid wait in the car for a few minutes while you drop off the Blockbuster video, and and you tell this to your play group or you tell this to a group of, you know, PTA moms, and they're all going, oh, my God, but what if, you know, what if the house burned down, or what if they were burglarized, or what if somebody smashed through the window and nobody in the entire parking lot noticed? First of all, you're admitting it so that other people can start admitting that they do these things too, that parenting is not all 100% perfect surveillance, and it doesn't have to be. So if people like me and you start saying, like, well, it doesn't seem so crazy to let your kid stay in the car for a few minutes, then you can sort of start dialing back the social norms a little bit. And then there's the idea of getting outside more. And, you know, and just one lady said that she lost her job, and she used to always walk her children to school. But once she lost her job, she didn't feel like getting dressed in the morning and doing it anymore. So lazy bones that she was, she let her kids walk to school by themselves. And then other kids started walking, you know, and it became a sort of neighborhood thing to do. Not that that happens across the board, but you do sometimes have to, you know, admit that this is the way that you want to raise your kids and try to bring some other parents on board and then try to lead by example and then hope that the example is so nice. You know, kids outside getting fresh air, kids waving to their neighbors, kids knowing the local dogs, that other people follow suit. And the idea of keeping them inside, not making a single decision by themselves, not choosing anything from, you know, what time their play date should end to what they should eat for, you know, a snack, doesn't do them any favors, because they do have to grow up and make these decisions. And I'm not saying they have to decide, you know, whether they should climb in a Mack truck with a stranger. I'm just saying they should be making decisions, little decisions, as they grow up, so that they can make bigger decisions as they get older.
That was my conversation with Lenore Scanese, who joined me in 2009 to discuss her book, Free Range Kids, Giving Our Kids the Freedom We Enjoyed Without Going Nuts with Worry. She's featured in the Discovery Life Channel series called World's Worst Mom. When we get back, we'll revisit my conversation with author Christina Baker Klein. Her book, Orphan Train, is this year's One Book, One Philadelphia selection. Stay with Radio Times in Review. Welcome back to Radio Times in Review. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We'll now listen to my recent conversation with author Christina Baker Klein. She joined me last month to discuss her novel Orphan Train, the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia 2015 selection. She's speaking at the library on March 19th for the grand finale. The book is about the turn-of-the-century orphan trains, and it's based on true accounts of children taken from their families and sent to the Midwest, often to work. This happened between the mid-19th century and the early 20th century. Let's give it a listen. Tell us about your personal connection to the story, because you learned that you had some family members that were orphans on this orphan train.
Right. I stumbled onto this story because I was visiting my in-laws in Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, in the middle of winter in a snowstorm with my children, holidays. And after several days, my mother-in-law, in desperation, pulled out a dusty book that she'd actually never looked at, which was filled with newspaper articles about her hometown, where she'd grown up, in Jamestown, North Dakota, tiny little place. Her father was president of the local savings and loan, and he was a sort of quiet, taciturn, stern man who never spoke about his past. But so she had received this book in the mail and never really looked through it. But in desperation, as I say, with my three boys running around, she corralled them and opened the book and started leafing through it. And they came across an article called it Orphan Train, and it proved there was a home for many children on the prairie. And my mother-in-law, as I mentioned, had grown up in this town until the age of 18, and apparently dozens, if not hundreds, of children from the orphan trains had ended up in that town, and yet she had never heard of it. Even more astounding, her father and his siblings were featured in this article with their photographs. So this was a huge shock to her. They were all dead at that point. She couldn't ask anyone about it. But it was astounding to all of us. It sent me on this journey. For a long time, I didn't feel that I was qualified to write the book, because it wasn't my own family history. And most of the people who'd written about the orphan trains had been related to train riders or historians. But finally, I had amassed enough information and I'd learned enough about it that I realized I was ready to start.
And it's so interesting when you think of possibly 200,000 children being taken from the East Coast to other parts of the country on a train in many ways by themselves. Was it a kind of shame or was it their kind of trauma? They just did not want to visit or revisit this time of their life?
There are actually a lot of factors. And by the way, they now say 250,000 children. Mm-hmm. The numbers are hard to quantify because terrible records were kept. In fact, they wanted the children to start over. They told them, the chaperones and the nuns who put them on the trains and escorted them across the country said, your parents are not your parents. Your past is not your past. Your life begins the moment you're chosen. Siblings were separated. Children, as you mentioned, were sent in a labor program. So there was a great stigma about it. These children looked and sounded and acted quite different from the children in these small conservative Midwestern communities, often Scandinavian communities. And, you know, we also can't discount the fact that there was no such thing as therapy at that time.
Sure.
For these children. And they were all severely traumatized in one way or another. As one train rider said to me, each one of us who rode on a train had been through some tremendous trauma. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been there. The trains were our last resort.
Well, in fact, Neve, the girl in your story of fire, her family comes from Ireland to New York City, and there's a fire, and in a sense sort of loses her family at that time.
Yeah.
And is put on a train. And one wonders, were all these children actually orphans? Were they largely immigrant children coming to big cities like New York?
When the trains began in 1854, there were 30,000 children living on the streets of New York City,
wow,
if you can imagine.
Wow.
So the train riders were, 30% of them, they figure, were orphaned. The rest were abandoned. They were runaways. They were taken out of homes. And they were actually plucked off the streets by the police. Parents would tell their children, don't go out after 6 o'clock because you might get put in a paddy wagon and put on an orphan train.
So they were seen as what, vagrants or troublemakers or just sort of riffraff that would cause problems for the city?
They were. There were no social programs. There was no welfare. There was no foster care. Children were property. Poor children, you know, pure and simple, were labor. But these children were dying in great numbers. They were going to prison. They were becoming prostitutes, joining gangs. They were getting run over, dying of exposure. Mm. They were considered a scourge. They called them street Arabs, vagrants.
Street Arabs?
Yes, that's what they called them. I know. So interesting. There's so many racial interesting things in all of this. And by the way, the Irish were particularly vulnerable to problems when they came to this country, having survived the Great Famine, if they did, and stumbled onto a boat and come across, only to face tremendous discrimination in this country as well. I always say when I talk about the book that every new immigrant group to this country goes through a hazing process. Part of what I really enjoyed doing this book was understanding, getting to learn about how different immigrant groups assimilated when they came over. And one last thing I also want to say, which
sure,
is, people often ask why children would be taken out of homes. If the problem was that they were homeless and there were way too many of them, why would you even take children out of homes? I didn't know until I began researching this book that in the mid to late 19th century, poverty was considered to be an inherited affliction. So if parents went to poor houses or if parents were particularly poor themselves, children were often taken away from them so that they wouldn't continue to be infected, so they wouldn't inherit this affliction that was passed from one generation to the next, which I just find fascinating.
Poverty is a kind of communicable disease.
It was a communicable disease, it was believed to be. And so, again, that's one of the reasons that train riders faced such stigma and trauma when they got to the Midwest. They were treated with great suspicion by a number of people. And so even the people who took them in often lied about where they'd gotten these children. They would say they'd gotten them from, like, a poor neighbor who had run into difficulties or a relative far away. They often didn't admit they'd gotten them from the orphan trains because there was such a stigma about that.
And I do want to get more to your novel, but another little piece of history, which I guess makes all this possible, is the laying of the railroad tracks in this growing country. And I guess even the Midwest, looking for people to live there, work there.
Oh, my goodness. The whole story of the railroads in our country is fascinating, and how they expanded and where and how they populated those unpopulated areas. What I found in my research was that the children, their travel was often subsidized by the train companies, who wanted to get bodies out to these rural areas where few people lived. And they were gambling on the idea that when these children got to the Midwest, they would not return to New York and to the East Coast. And in fact, they could not have been more right. Not only did most children never return to the East Coast, most of them never even left the small communities that they were put into, much less the states they went into. One train rider was explaining to me that she said, "We had been through so much turmoil, I just wanted to stay put." And so that's what most of them did.
You include in your novel, a kind of a wanted or an advertisement, homes for orphan children. A company of homeless children from the East will arrive at Milwaukee Road Depot Friday, October 18th. Distribution will take place at 10 a.m. These children are of various ages and both sexes, having been thrown friendless upon the world.
Isn't that just astounding?
Is that almost word for word from an ad that you might have seen in your research?
It is word for word. And when I give my presentation, I do a slideshow with all these incredible slides of indenture certificates and photographs and these kinds of things. And I have the actual poster that I quoted from. That is actually what they said, that they, having been thrown friendless upon the world. And they also, that same poster goes on to say that these children are come from somewhat respectable families, so that they're therefore desirable children and worthy of good homes.
Of course, this is before child labor laws. I mean, are we talking slavery here? Are we talking indentured servitude? And many of these children working on farms, working in houses.
Yeah, they were actually called indentured servants, or they were contracted. There were two ways of doing it. They were indentured to the age of 18 or 21. So imagine being a homeless kid from the streets of New York, and by the way, the most desirable ones, of course, as you might imagine, boys from 9 to 14 years old who could be pure labor on the farms. Maybe you belong to a gang. Maybe you haven't had a home for a while. Maybe you've just been roaming the streets. And suddenly you are essentially slave labor until the age of 21, and you have no choice about it. Not only that, there was no screening process. So there was almost no oversight. So, yes, there are many parallels. And, in fact, the National Orphan Train Complex says that in many instances these children took the place of slaves. And they even went into slaveholding states. I have a map that shows how far these children went all over the United States. And they did, in some instances, slavery was just ending, replace slaves.
This idea of changing people's names, and this happens quite a bit in this novel, and I know it's also happened with immigrant families coming to Ellis Island, where oftentimes the officials at the island would change someone's last name, you know, to make it more Americanized. But it's such a profound thing to do to someone, especially to a child.
It is, and, you know, the closest thing to it, I guess, is taking in a rescue pet and naming it something else, which people do all the time.
Yes.
I think that, you know, these immigrant children were looked at with suspicion and also as not 100% human in some ways, not always. You know, many people who took in the children, especially the babies, treated them kindly and with compassion. But for many people, they were labor. And they were a little bit less than human in the way that slaves were considered a little bit less than human.
But it does seem, I mean, she is, Neve, she is a strong and resilient young woman. Then we know her as an older woman, an elderly woman.
I do think that these train riders ultimately came past shame, a lot of them because their descendants were so excited about it, so passionate about trying to find out what had happened to them. You know, the birth certificates of these people were altered, destroyed, and locked up by the organizations. They really didn't want them to trace back where they had come to where they had come from. So it's difficult for their descendants to find out what happened in many cases. But they're trying. And so the reunions are now filled with hundreds of descendants with three-ring binders looking for information. There was often a two-tiered family system where the children in a household might be treated by blood might be treated differently than the train riders. So it was hard for these children. It was hard to assimilate. It was hard to come through. Some of them thrived. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that.
I mean, were you interested as a writer to sort of trying to understand how someone processes and deals with trauma? I mean, really, in many ways, this is trauma.
Yeah, that was actually my initial sort of framework or interest in the story was about the legacy of trauma and how people come through to the other side. Catherine Harrison is a wonderful writer, and she's written a lot about trauma. And she says that when you undergo a tremendous trauma, you step into a kind of parallel world where you have to look. You, on the outside, no one really knows, but what you're experiencing inside is so disconnected from how you express yourself that it's hard to reconcile. And you step into a kind of a different world that you can't explain readily.
There's another character, if I can say, in the story. This is Molly Eyre. She's a teenager. She is living in the same town as Vivian in Maine. And she is, in a sense, aging out of the foster care system. So she's almost ready to graduate high school. Did you see some parallels between Molly's story and Vivian's story?
There are obvious parallels between their stories. This is going to sound incredibly naive, but I didn't realize quite how many until I had finished a draft. I grew up in Bangor, Maine, 10 miles from Indian Island, and there were Native children in my community, and I had never written about it before, and about the Penobscots explicitly. And also my mother was very involved in Native American rights in Maine. She was in the Maine State Legislature, and she passed all this legislation with this wonderful Wabanaki elder, the only Indian elected legislator in the state of Maine, Donna Loring, to protect Indian rights in all these ways. And so she was very involved in that, and that was another aspect of the Molly story.
Seems like Maine figures pretty strongly in some of your writing.
It does. And in Orphan Train, there's a little town called Spruce Harbor, which I made up, which is on Mount, I call it Mount Desert Island, but some locals say Desert.
Mount Desert Island.
Island, yes. And it's on the quiet side of the island between or around Southwest Harbor and Bass Harbor. I have a house in Southwest Harbor, and I didn't want a real place because I wanted to be able to change some details and have Main Street where I wanted it to be. I've used Spruce Harbor in a number of novels, and I will continue to do so.
Have you always wanted to write?
I always wrote, and I never presumed, or perhaps had the confidence to believe that I would be able to necessarily make a living at it. What I have always told my students when I teach, I've taught a lot of college, is that I think the answer for how this all happened is that I tended to follow the yes. When people said no, which was often, I would usually turn around and listen to the person, maybe the only person, who was encouraging me and go in that direction.
That was my conversation with Christina Baker Klein, author of Orphan Train, the Free Library of Philadelphia's One Book, One Philadelphia selection this year. That's it for this week's edition of Radio Times in Review. Radio Times is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for listening.